Hey guys, come on in, sit down and relax, put in your fancy iPhone earbuds. You're about to listen to Let's Talk Iran and Stuff, a podcast about all things Iran related and pretty much anything else I find to be particularly interesting. I'm your host. My name is Reza Marashi. I'm an Iranian American. I'm a lovable jerk. I'm a big fan of baklava milkshakes. And most importantly, I'm the research director at the National Iranian American Council. I'm sitting here live in my office in Washington, D.C., and before we go any further, make sure to check out and support NIAC at www.niacouncil.org, and you can also check us out on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or Google or MySpace or Ask Jeeves, but not really those last two. This is episode number two of the podcast since our reboot. Shout out to Eric Ferrari for killing it on episode number one. If you haven't listened to it yet, you definitely need to check it out. For new listeners, here's a quick refresher course about the mission of this podcast. In my eternal quest to give knowledge to the people, I'm going to hit up as many friends and colleagues as possible to share their expertise with you about all things Iran related. Like a fine wine, this podcast will only get better with age, so if you keep listening, I'll keep providing you with top-notch content that's free of the typical Washington, D.C. spin, and that's a Reza Marashi promise. This week, my guest is Shervi Malekzadeh. He's a visiting scholar at the University of Pennsylvania's Middle East Center. Prior to that, he was a visiting assistant professor in political science at Swarthmore College. He received his PhD in government from Georgetown University, and his research focuses on the politics of schooling, culture, and identity in post-revolutionary Iran. In my humble opinion, you won't find a more thoughtful guy writing about Iran-related issues today. Shervin and I talked about the interplay between state and society in Iran, his fieldwork in Iran during the past three elections, and female lead singers and rock bands. I think you're going to like it a lot, I think you're going to learn a lot, and much respect to Shervin for agreeing to chop it up with me. So, without further ado, enjoy the show. Things on. I think we're live.
All right. Good. Let's do this.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Much appreciated. It was a pleasant surprise because I got the impromptu, hey, I'm coming to town.
That's right.
Do you want to do this podcast? And I was like, do I want to do this podcast? Of course I do. So it's much appreciated.
It is my way to just randomly show up.
Well, I'm picky about who I invite to do this because I have to think that the person actually has genuinely interesting things to say.
Thank you.
So I have not sent out a tremendous amount of invitations to people to do this. Yeah. It's very much like I have a group of people. Yeah. I sent out emails. Some were cool with it. Some couldn't do it for a variety of reasons.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if I find more people that I find to be particularly interesting, then I'll ask them. But you were definitely in the first batch.
Wow.
Yeah.
What can I say, man?
Yeah.
Hopefully I will live up to that.
Well, we're doing it.
And that esteem. Yeah.
We're doing it. And, you know, I think one of the ways that you live up to it is you picked a cool song for the intro. A song I'd never heard before.
Yep.
And so we listened to it. And always with two V's.
That's
so
right.
So I already dig the cool spelling.
Yeah.
The song was called Next of Kin. And female lead singer,
which is
awesome.
That's my kryptonite.
Because you
female
don't
vocalist.
See a lot of that in rock and roll bands this day and age. And historically, if you look back over time, as rock and roll music has evolved into a variety of genres, whether you're talking about 80s rock, punk, proto-punk, things that came out even before Bowie. You know, people always like, oh, Janis Joplin. They talk about like a core, like the same three, four, five female lead singers, but there's actually a lot of cool ones, and her voice in particular is pretty cool. So tell me a little bit about what particularly appealed to you about this song, this band.
So, this band, I discovered, this is a classic hipster scenario. You know, in my coffee shop, as my dad would say, what are all these people doing here at 11 in the morning?
Like, hippies, get a job.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, I'm a sucker. I've always been a sucker for female vocalists. I've been accused of liking this band because the lead singer is, she's a beautiful lady as well. But it's the voice and, frankly, you know, this song that I'm assuming you've already played here on this podcast.
We have.
Walk into this world.
We have. That's how it works.
Editing process.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very upbeat and happy type of song. I used to listen to a lot of Brazilian music. It was the sort of same deal, very somber, perhaps even sad or dark message, but concealed behind this like poppy kind of beat. And the lyrics are really wry, really cynical, in fact. You know, the story of this guy who they're on a date. I mean, the title of the song, Next of Kin, is already hinting what's about to happen.
Right.
This dude's going down. And I love the song because it's unclear whether maybe she pushed him into the water. I allow myself to imagine that. It took me on, as I mentioned before we started this recording, you know, my third or fourth listening, resonantly. She mentions almost in passing that he took some sort of medication, right? Take away the anxiety, and that's probably what did it, right? So he slips into the waters. And of course, she has the line about, if I didn't know you couldn't swim, I would have never gone in. I just think that's hilarious. So I like to entertain myself with dark, somber music that's actually happy sounding. So.
Well, I mean, there's something to be said for having creative lyrics that actually tell a story that might be a bit, if not counterintuitive, then clever, put together in a clever way.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm very appreciative of bands that make that effort. I mean, aside from just for whatever reason being drawn to that sort of female vocalist.
Yeah.
But I'm interested that you, because I know your thing is punk, right? Like, it seems like women had a pretty, or am I misreading this? I'm just thinking of Joan Jett specifically.
Jett's obviously legendary, but I mean, there's the whole Riot Girl movement.
Sure.
Anybody that listens to punk rock music, Riot Girl movement was huge.
Yeah.
But for me personally, if we're talking about female lead singers in punk rock, the band X and the song Los Angeles is seminal.
Yeah.
And I don't know anybody that's truly a fan of punk rock music that wouldn't point to that song as one of the best to come out in the early to beginning eras of punk. And that album in particular, coming out of Los Angeles and really, I think, setting the tone, setting the vibe for the punk scene that ended up emerging out of California, because a lot of stuff was coming out of New York first,
right,
and then London with, you know, the Sex Pistols and the Clash and all those guys. But really, the Ramones invented this.
Yeah.
And then X in Los Angeles came out, and amazing female lead singer. There's a long list of them in punk rock, for sure. A long, long list.
I mean, is punk rock, I mean, I know there's a whole race sort of component that emerges out of punk rock, right, and class and all that, but the gender stuff, you said the Riot Girl movement, so that's definitely, but to me that's an appropriation or reappropriation perhaps of the super macho scene, maybe, or am I misreading it, like punk and its origins?
Punk wasn't monolithic by a stretch of the imagination, right?
Okay.
Like, I think in the beginning, it was counterculture movement, and there was a big DIY component to it. And I think a lot of people that were drawn to punk rock and that continue to be drawn to punk rock never really feel like they fit into things that were particularly conventional, and didn't really jive with or didn't believe in a lot of the BS that they felt were coming from a variety of different sources, be it government or education or just conventional wisdom broadly perceived. And I think,
or disco, right? I mean, it was a response to disco.
Yeah, that was certainly part of it too. And then within the early punk movement, just like within life broadly conceived, I think you had a lot of guys that were not treating women with respect. And then you saw punk women stand up and show their punk rock roots and their belief in the culture and say, this is not what it's about. And I think it took off from there. And it became a thing. And I mean, I know I grew up with, particularly in Seattle, a lot of Riot Girls, and
it
was super cool to see them at shows. And you could tell who they were because they like weren't holding their boyfriend's stuff, and they were there doing their own thing. And it was the vibe was super cool.
Yeah, yeah. Or they didn't have boyfriends, right? I mean, that's a big part of the sort of the queer movement comes out of that. For me, at least.
Certainly part of it too.
Yeah,
certainly part of it too.
Cool.
It's super hard to nail down. I mean, if we're talking about punk specifically, it's super hard to nail down like one particular movement or one particular strain of thought, because there's so many subgenres within the broader genre itself, and you know there's certain aspects of it that I dig more than others. And
you and me randomly catching the Ramones documentary and the tragedy. I just saw the Rolling Stones cover piece on the tragedy, quote unquote, of the Ramones. You know, the sort of story of this band. You know, like hanging out with you and then really realizing how important the Ramones were and the sort of backstory to that band has been a huge revelation for me.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
You know,
I'm just impressed these guys, and I think the Beastie Boys kind of, which is more in line of what I kind of came up with too. Like, you know, you realize these guys couldn't play. And how did they learn how to play? That's always been a source of fascination for me. They figured it out. You know, like, is it because they stuck with it or they had a natural talent, which is why they were called to sing this sort of music? And of course, nowadays, like, you have all these, like, you know, in Iran, they have The Voice, and here, American Idol, and I guess actually the voices here, what's the Iranian version? Oh, a stage, right? You know, these sort of shows where it's sort of mass produced, heavily produced, focused strictly on people who already know how to sing, right?
Yeah.
Which to me is the antithesis of what punk kind of stands for.
Yeah, in more ways than one.
Yeah.
In more ways than one, you know, and I think...
The more the merrier, I suppose, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's no... I mean, if you want to be a punk rock kid, there's no real rules.
Yeah.
You know, and I think what it comes down to at the end of the day is, you know, do you get down with the music? You know, do you believe in yourself? Do you believe in doing things the way that you believe that they should be, done?
Yeah.
It's very much a DIY culture. It's very much about not letting society or conventional wisdom dictate how you should think or how things should be.
Yeah.
And, I mean, if you can't get down with that, then generally, you don't have to be into punk rock music,
right.
But if you can't get down with that concept about believing in yourself,
yeah,
and believing in doing what you think is right in life, generally speaking, then I don't know.
But what happens then when all this, you know, like, for me, when I was a kid, the guys with the spiky hair was a kind of a scary thing, you know, the rebellious, right? Like you're saying, DIY to the extreme, right? When you run that safety pin through your nose, right, that's DIY at its maximum. But then it becomes commodified, right? Becomes a thing.
It's totally.
Something to,
totally.
What do you do if you're a punk, you know, punk rocker, and, like, suddenly this, like, industry emerges around you, or a subgenre, you know, like, then you want to be artificial, like, create new arenas for singing music, right? You just kind of want to keep doing your own thing, but suddenly you've been embedded without even wanting to in this bigger...
I mean, has the appropriation happened? 100%.
Sure.
But all that's done is kind of allowed people who are at the forefront of bringing punk rock into the mainstream and spreading the gospel to the masses.
Yeah.
See, we told you so.
Yeah.
Everything that they were pointing out,
okay,
that was, you know, about appropriation and a bunch of people,
yeah,
just being sheep and in more ways than one,
yeah,
ended up happening in its most roundabout
ironic
and full ironic extent,
yeah,
because their own culture was then expropriated. Like, when you see
that's
people
hilarious
wearing leather jackets with, you know, all the stuff, and it's just like,
yeah,
are you kidding me? I used to get made fun of for wearing that stuff.
That's hilarious.
You know?
Did you get beat down for that?
No, I got, if I ever got beat up, it was because I have a big mouth. But
those two go together,
right? Oftentimes. Yeah,
hilarious.
Oftentimes. But I mean, it, having a big mouth allowed me to do what I do now for a living, so it worked out well.
Well, I love it that you still, I mean, here you are in button-down D.C., working on a very, needless to say, touchy subject, right?
Right.
And you're staying true to the whole punk thing in your own way. It's pretty cool. So.
Well, you know, that's there's something to be said for you doing kind of the same thing. I mean,
yeah,
you know, you...
got to entertain ourselves, right?
I mean,
it's my whole thing. So.
You write what you think. You write what you believe. You don't really worry about whether or not it's going to be digestible politically in Washington, D.C. And I think that's pretty cool, you know, because this is actually a good segue into what we're actually
going
to talk
go
about, you know. But
this is where people turn it off.
People like the music. People like the music conversation.
Yeah.
They can relate to it.
No,
you
that's
know
what I'm saying. That's all I want.
But, you know, you've done some pretty interesting research.
Appreciate it.
And I think your research, which we want to talk about, has highlighted a lot of stuff that doesn't necessarily jive with conventional wisdom as Iran or the Islamic Republic is generally understood in the U.S. I mean, you've done research that focuses on the politics of schooling, culture, and identity in post-revolutionary Iran.
Yeah.
You know, you've received your PhD in government from Georgetown University. Obviously, in order to get the PhD, you had to do a dissertation.
Right.
So tell the people, give knowledge to the people, and explain a little bit about what your field work was, and some of the main findings that were articulated in your dissertation.
Cool. Yeah, I mean, just right off top, piggybacking off of what you said, I mean, Iran, in many ways, if you want to do this Iran business, there's two ways you can go. You can be a total native informant, right? Iranians are bad, they're evil, let me tell you why. I was there, I grew up in this culture, and you guys are all right. And so, but that same conventional wisdom also becomes the easiest foil by which to be quote-unquote original, right? Which is what academia, you know, devours, I guess, if it devours anything other than souls and lives. It seeks, you know, the sort of almost an artificial extent type of originality that's not existent, building off of literature, but that's not there. So, you know, if any sort of counterintuitive writing about Iran, hey, guess what? Iranians like pizza. Hey, guess what? Iranians have nostalgia.
Yeah.
Hey, guess what? Iranians hang out with their families and are chill most of the time and not shouting death to Israel, death to the U.S. No way. Are you kidding me? So, you know, it was, the bar is very low, I think, in many ways. There was an article in the Times, and I don't mind saying this on a recording, you know, another classic example. I went off on this on the Facebook, which is the worst forum to do this.
But the forum
actress's name. Usually. Yeah, exactly. I'm not on the Twitter machine yet. I'm on the Zuckerberg machine still.
Mm.
But you know, this idea. I'm avoiding the question. I realize I'll wheel back to the answer here in a second. But I forgot the actress's name. But the film that did really very well at Cannes. It was mentioned that she was the Natalie Portman. Some say, right, the classic. Passive voice. Some say that she's Natalie Portman of Iran. Like, dude, she's the whatever her name is of Iran.
Yeah.
There is no Brad Pitt of Iran or Frank Sinatra of Iran. You know, it turns out Iranians have their own actors and singers. They don't necessarily derive from or are in reference to American cultural output. Though, of course, that's there as well, right? I mean, there's certainly an influence. And that's not, you know, you don't want to be too PC with this stuff, but this, the other beef and pet peeve I have is, and we've talked about this, and when they do an article about Iran, they always show the same damn. Can I cuss on this thing?
You can. We want to make sure that the children can listen to them. You can say damn. Damn's not.
Okay, damn's right. Okay. I was going to say something. They show the same wall from the side of the embassy, U.S. embassy, NASA spies. And yeah. I've talked to you about this endlessly, I think. My aunt lives like a block or two away. And I call it Skeletor Statue of Liberty or the evil Statue of Liberty. And it's always the same lady or set of ladies in chadors. And they're always moving horizontally in the background. I'm like, dude, I've seen all sorts of people, punk people in front of that stupid sign, me in front of that sign, you know, with a grad student ponytail or whatever. And it's actually a mural on the side of the wall.
Yeah.
Somehow that's emblematic of what Iran is about, you know, or so it's presented ironically, like. You know, oh, here's Iran talking about reaching out to the U.S., but then they have this evil wall or whatever. And so these sort of cliches are out there. And this is, you know, when I went into the work, I came out of teaching here. Shout out to Bancroft Elementary School, Mount Pleasant.
Nice.
I taught kindergarten, first grade there. Taught at Edison Brentwood in East Palo Alto. You know, I did my do-gooder phase as a teacher, right?
Yeah, share everything for the children.
That's right. Not brought the knowledge to the kids.
Absolutely.
You know, and I learned a lot teaching these guys. Teaching is the best way to learn. And what I learned is it's tough to teach Columbus Day or Thanksgiving to a group of, you know, Latinos who perhaps have indigenous origins, right? So how do I talk about this dude Columbus that I grew up with or the first Thanksgiving dinner, which I assume both of us grew up with, as being an emblem of our American mosaic, right, or a little piece of it, the kind of thing that helps stitch us together, to mix my metaphors now. I think it's very important as teachers when you're teaching immigrant communities, I'm an immigrant too, you know, to make Americans, to make us unified. And what I found was myself negotiating with this material, like, you know, Columbus is a crazy man. Like, he did horrible things, took slaves back to Spain. He, you know, he butchered the people, you know, Hispaniola. Saying it incorrectly, but you know, the island that he landed on. And so anyways, from that story, I got this sort of thinking about, okay, how does this work in Iran, in a country like Iran, where you have an explicit and openly ideological curriculum, unlike the U.S. where the ideology is perhaps in a hidden curriculum, right? More subtle, I think, and perhaps not as pernicious. I wanted to have someone pay for me and support me as I go back to Iran and get back in touch with the roots, that whole thing. But I was very curious on, in terms of, you know, people who work on PhDs tend to write their own stories. And so me writing about how identity was formed in Iran through schooling was a way for me to grapple with my own experience growing up in the States, being in kindergarten, introduced to American society, basically right as the hostages were happening.
Yeah.
They were released in first grade. And that was really a crappy experience, you know, for so many of us. I mean, whatever, things worked out in the end, I think. Ultimately, we all became Americans. It was not a problem. But, you know, it was the sort of pain and pressure that, of course, our parents went through much, much worse than us as kids. But, negotiating a world and a curriculum that perhaps doesn't match what you think of yourself. You know, how do you go between these two cultures? And so, anyways, in Iran, after the revolution, obviously, there's a shift, a major shift, between the Shah's regime and the Islamic regime. And I was very curious to see how the state had succeeded or failed specifically in inculcating or presenting this sort of Islamic set of values, you know, as the revolution was described, revolution of values. Of course, the contradiction or paradox is that the revolution occurred because Iranians are Islamic, right? I mean, it's a virtuous revolution because it's reclaiming the authentic Iran. So what need is there to teach Islam to a society that's already Islamic, you know? And I came in there I went into my fieldwork seeking the binary, right? Opposition or acceptance, right? Brainwash or resisting. And I think that's the image that's presented here very often, not just in Iran, but in schooling in general.
Right.
Again, I work with 5- and 6-year-olds, and anybody who's worked with them knows that, you know, aside from picking nose and, like, you know, maybe wetting their pants now and then, they have a lot of power, especially when they're 20 or 30 of them in a room.
Yeah.
Right? I don't get – so the notion is that little guys are putty and they're shaped by the state, right, or by the agent of the state, the teacher, at least in the U.S. context, but certainly in the Iranian context. And then when they get to college, they become rebels. And this is certainly the cliche we have about Iran, right? Kids are being trained to hate the West, to hate Israel, to export the revolution. Then they go to college and they lose their minds, right? They turn against because now they have knowledge suddenly, sort of independent knowledge. So I was curious to see how this was actually playing out. What were the outcomes? And assuming that the inputs, the curriculum, the message state was delivering was actually coherent, consistent. And Reza, what I learned very quickly, man, is you know, notions of resistance and domination are very abstract and simple ways of approaching schooling in any context, right? Guy who works in the Ministry of Ed, who I was interviewing, made the point that his son's very pious, observes Ramadan, he fasts, he does everything. You're supposed to get up in the morning, does his prayers, but he hates the regime, top to bottom. Why? He's a punk. He likes to bring his music to school. He likes to do his hair his own way. And they hassle him. This is in high school, right? They hassle him for that. So how does this kid who appears to be very pious and Islamic by any standard, right? Certainly the regime standard, the state standard in Iran, this kid despises schooling in Iran and what the message is being given to him. Is that a resistance? You know, he's doing everything he's supposed to as an Islamic citizen, the new Islamic citizen. He just doesn't like the system. So that really got me thinking that, you know, there's another way of looking at this, that somehow domination, resistance might be simultaneous. I'm going to use a little academic jargon.
Yeah, do it.
I apologize for that.
Nah, do it.
Social science geeking here.
Yeah.
Yeah, they sort of enable each other, I think. There's a lot written on this, sort of simultaneous events, I think. I just learned that in the 1906 constitutional movement, a lot of the discourse of language was actually this, the state's language, you know, this idea of the Shah being the agent of the people. And they, you know, a lot of the protests were basically using the new constitutional assembly as a way of replacing the Shah's role. But this was a sort of unintended consequence that emerged out of not inventing a new politics or ideology on the part of the participants in that earliest revolution in Iran,
yeah,
but taking what was already there. And I, you know, I was fortunate to be in Iran in 2009. I saw that exactly happening, that people were resisting their the abuse by the part of the state by using the language of the state. So again, domination and resistance, I think, were occurring simultaneously, enabling each other, right? They had a language of Islam to use against the state. Islam doesn't allow you to steal votes, et cetera. So anyways, the point is, how do you tie all this back to schooling? I think lately what I've discovered is that what you see through schooling is not so much inputs leading to outcomes, but sort of growing up together, maybe, is the way to describe it, between state and society over these almost 40 years now. Shaping each other and sort of understanding each other's needs. And of course, the division between state and society is not a real thing. They blur, I think. But pulling kids into school and the state, for its part, creating a sort of coherent message about what this revolution is about has been the process that I've been trying to track. And there's been some very surprising evidence, at least what I've been able to see, come out of this. Specifically that they didn't have their act together for many years in terms of what it means to be an Islamic citizen, what it means to be a revolutionary citizen. But where they did have their act together were the sort of things or concepts that have always been in Iran since the dawn of modernity, around 19th century, that Iran's national borders need to be preserved and Iran needs to catch up with the West and become modern. And it turns out nationalism and modernity in terms of technology and science, there's nothing different in 79, 80 than what was there in 75, 76. In fact, some of those same lessons are repeated for years, well into the 90s, where you see rupture or discontinuity is actually around this notion of what it means to be Islamic.
Yeah.
So the politics of the schooling is actually not between, hey, do we make this society Islamic or not? Are we succeeding or not? It's trying to figure out their own message, the state's own message in terms of inculcating these kids. But the bigger project of schooling and education, I think, is the big surprise for me has been how consistent it's been before and after the revolution. So So very, very long-winded and probably hard to follow set of comments I just made here. But, you know, to loop it back to what we talked about, the foil would be that 79, 78 to 80, a lot changes in schooling. Khomeini comes in and says, this is how things need to be, right? And it's very different from the Shah's regime. Pre-Islamic, perhaps even anti-religious, beholden to the West, etc. And somehow, after the revolution, the Iranian school system becomes this anti-Western, anti-imperialist, hardcore Islamic, no more kings, no more discussion of nations, because, you know, for the Islamist, nationalism is a Western imposition to divide the ummah, right, the community of believers. And in fact, that's all BS. Like, from the beginning, they basically talked about Iran, alongside the Islamic stuff, by the way. But these two things, I think what's important is to understand is that these are not contradictory notions for this regime, because this regime or Nizam emerges, system emerges out of a legacy of over 100 years of trying to, you know, create a sort of independence and autonomy for Iran to escape the traumas of the 19th century when the Russians basically handed Iranians their, you know what, you know, in war. And this is constantly, of course, referenced by people like Zarif to this very day. We haven't invaded a country in 200 years. That's sort of rhetoric.
Absolutely.
So I think that's been very fascinating for me to watch how the school system, or to observe how the school system has been a way, again, for the development of the state, sort of with a society, sort of shaping each other around this shared language or discourse of what it means to be Iranian, which is not fixed, right? It's not a static thing. It's constantly in flux and changing. So it's, in some ways, it's very challenging to write about this stuff or even talk about it now. I could be more succinct, I suppose. I'm sure half your listeners are thinking this right now.
But, not at all.
I mean, it's just a convoluted process that's never ending. You know, and this is the whole notion of state formation. It's just, there is no zero and one, right? Beginning and end. It's just you have to get in there and try to figure out a certain time frame that you want to study and then present that message. Yeah.
Well, I mean, this is interesting because, I mean, your research touches upon something that I find to be particularly fascinating, and something that I found have increasingly come to realize is what the Iranian government across the political spectrum really prioritizes, perhaps above all else. It's this idea of the relationship between state and society and the degree to which the gap between state and society is either growing or receding.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think your research on education is particularly poignant when it comes to this issue because, you know, acknowledging that it is a priority, if not the priority, manifests itself in the way that they try to provide education from the very beginning all the way through university.
Absolutely. I mean, the logic of this regime, and here, like, I can speak very succinctly, finally, like, you know, the logic of this revolution is that we can deliver modernity in a more virtuous manner than East, Sharq, or West, God, right? The godless or the materialist liberal democracies, and certainly the godless Soviet or communist system, quote, these are all quote unquotes, right? Your viewers can't, your listeners can't see, I'm doing air quotes. Iran has to deliver schooling. And this is what I think distinguishes Iran from the other regimes in the region, all awful regimes, by the way, but in many ways, the virtue of this system is that it's trapped by its own logic or desire to legitimize itself by delivering the goodies, as our good friend Muhammad Ayatollah Tabar always says, the moodies as well, right? Both the immaterial and material goods. So they have to provide schooling, not just for the 10% who could get into university, our parents, right, who grew up in Iran. You know, it was until the 90s, basically, maybe early 2000s, only 10 or 13% could get into university. So what you saw is, I wrote about this last year, in 2006, it starts to change, but half of high school kids dropped out. Right, they dropped out of their first year up until the year 2006. I think it was like 70% in the countryside because they couldn't get into university.
Yeah.
So now the state has basically allowed, and a lot of this occurred, crazily enough, under Ahmadinejad.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The expansion of the private sector or the sort of distance learning sector, which is actually technically under public schooling in Iran, universities basically become 100% deal. You as a high school graduate should be able to get into some sort of university. You might have to spend money. You might have to go live out way out from where your folks are.
Right.
But there's really no way that you can't go to university anymore.
Right.
If you have the means. And this is revolutionary. I can't emphasize this enough, how traumatic it was for Iranians for many decades before and after revolution that only 10% could get into only these excellent universities that existed, right? The elite students could get in. And now basically 100% of high school students could get in. I think it's half of all kids 18 to 34 are going to, it might be 24, are in some sort of higher education right now. This is a huge shift in terms of state-society relationship in Iran.
Absolutely.
So this is dope, right? If you're a kid, wow, I can go to school, I can get a good job, and last mention is I can get married, right? You have to be educated to get married.
Yeah.
This is huge, and it would seem like, wow, the state has really sowed the seeds of its own demise by creating this society, you know, bridging, like you said, that gap between state and society through the schooling that families so desire in Iran, everywhere in the world, by the way. But actually what I'm finding is that this might be a way to reduce the gap between state and society such that they become even more complicit in each other's lives. In other words, this idea of schooling and education leading to a possible downfall of the state or of this regime is actually less likely now, for the same reason that it's less likely in the U.S. that a Swarthmore grad, and I say this to my students who are Harvard grads, going to go out there and, you know, burn bridges or protest or stand in the middle of the street with a bunch of people and throw rocks at the state. You know, now you're plugged in. Once that gap between state and society, and this might be a good thing actually, is reduced to the point where you rely on the provision of educational resources either in the private or public sector, then it's much less likely you're going to screw things up because your future is now at stake. Even as a 20-year-old or a 24-year-old, you recognize this.
Absolutely.
And so I think I ended up being long-winded again, but I think the successful project of the state in terms of bringing the embrace of society, you know, embracing each other, has been the provision of schooling and education, because now people are relying on this public resource, which, by the way, they're appropriating for private use.
Yeah.
Right? So that tension is what's happening now in Iran. This sort of mutual dependence that state and society have on each other around this particular institution or industry of education and schooling. It's a really fascinating story.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's so here we have a situation where, you know, we don't even have to be talking about Iran. We happen to be talking about Iran now, but generally speaking, I've always believed that you have, within a population, political, economic, and social aspirations.
Yeah.
And when we talk about education specifically, I think that falls into, at least a little bit, all three of those categories.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
So if it is the state's responsibility, and I believe that it is, whether you're talking about Iran, the United States, or any country in between, to help fulfill the political, economic, and social aspirations of their people, and the Iranian government is able to do it in some ways better than others, then I think your hypothesis is correct.
Yeah.
And I think if we're going to take a step back and look at it at a more macro level, my view is that this is precisely the driving force behind what the Rouhani government has been trying to do. They realized that the gap between state and society was growing increasingly large, to dangerous levels, and they did not have the political space as a result of external tensions with the rest of the world to address the internal problems.
Yeah.
So they resolved, largely though not entirely, the external problems vis-a-vis the U.S. and other places. Obviously, there's still external problems with the Saudis and others, but the 8,000-pound gorilla in the room, the nuclear issue, resolved, and now they have more ability, more attention, more resources for the internal problems.
Yeah. But see, this is a tricky... So an authoritarian, if you want to call Iran an authoritarian or semi-authoritarian state, I think the latter is closer to reality.
Right.
Why would you get rid of that external threat? That's your excuse for screwing things up at home, right?
Well, you haven't gotten rid of it entirely.
Okay.
Right?
I mean, this is what I learned from the work you've done, Trita's done, Nayak's done, you know, is... Yeah, solving the so-called, you know, all the sanctions stuff and the nuclear, which is, we can talk about this if you want. Like, I've always thought the nuclear thing was much ado about nothing, ultimately.
But, I agree.
Yeah. that's a side note. But anyways, like, that allows them to say, look, man, we can't fix the economy because look at what the Americans are doing to us. What's the motivation to get rid of it? I mean, you're right. Like, the threat is obviously now there's some creeping back in of the sort of... punitive policies, foreign policy that Americans have had. Maybe they never went away, really. But it seems like, you know, if the whole point is to, like, have an excuse to legitimize the state or the system, then why would you... I mean, you could look at it the other way, right? I mean, I get what you're saying. Like, it frees their hand to see to the economy, to see to domestic issues, to reduce that gap between state and society. But on the other hand, you know, the U.S. has always played a very convenient foil. Use that term again. So how do you read that? I mean...
I think the problems in U.S.-Iran relations manifested themselves through the nuclear issue, where the nuclear issue became the 8,000-pound gorilla in the room.
Okay.
It wasn't the only problem, but it became the problem that completely shut off the political space in Washington and Tehran to address any other issue, right? And right now, even though Iran has fulfilled all of its obligations under the nuclear deal, as verified by the International Atomic Energy Agency, there are some problems on the sanctions front. More specifically, the U.S. sanctions front, the non-nuclear sanctions that still exist.
Yeah.
And because these problems have not been troubleshooted by the U.S., Iran, and other members of the P5 plus one, the other countries that helped negotiate the nuclear deal, they are not able to address issues like Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan.
The Iranians aren't able.
Nobody is.
Yeah.
Because the Iranians are basically saying, this needs to be fixed.
Yeah.
Like, we need to fix this, and then we can talk about the other issues.
But domestically, what do you think? I mean, is it...
Domestically, I mean, look, if you rewind the clock back to the early 1990s up until the real backbreaking sanctions started to bite, to end of 2011, beginning of 2012, I think you saw Iran try to essentially have its cake and eat it too.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't think... And what do I mean by that? I mean, in my view, I think you have a good number of Iranian officials that... consider the United States to be an adversary, right?
Yeah.
But that's fundamentally different depending on which genre of Iranian official you talk to.
Right.
Some will say that Iran and the U.S. are enemies. They always will be.
Right.
And some will say, no, we're rivals. We're competitors.
Frenemies.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that both sides are open to testing the possibility of having the frenemies or rivals or competitors where the relationship more resembles U.S.-China relations or U.S.-Russia relations.
Yeah.
There's no perfect analogy, but that's the closest one you can get to. And I think Iranians can live with that.
Yeah, yeah.
But what no Iranian official, from monarchist to mullah and everybody in between, in my view, can live with is a patron-client relationship
I
that
agree.
Existed under the time of the Shah where America says jump and the Iranians are supposed to say how high.
Absolutely.
I don't think any Iranian official would agree to that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right on that.
Yeah. But so...
Yeah.
Bringing it back,
okay.
You know, gap between state and society and the ability to close it off or at least reduce it because, you know, obviously Iranian government shortcomings and in this regard are plentiful. I mean, you had the ability to visit Iran a bunch of different times, you know, and more interestingly, you were there during the time of 2009 election, you were there for the 2013 election, and you were there more recently for elections in 2016.
Yeah.
And this issue of the gap between state and society and is the government doing a good enough job at fulfilling the aspirations of people, whatever those aspirations might be.
Sure.
I mean, this is when it manifests itself more than any other time. So, I mean, talk a little bit about the similarities and differences in what you saw during these different trips.
Yeah, I was actually about to step into that perhaps treacherous waters. But, it's funny. Like, I only go to Iran when there are, like, dramatic historical shifts, apparently, in its history. So
you have good timing.
I have a good timing, yeah. So, yeah, 2009, of course, was totally unanticipated, as I think was 2013. And to a certain extent, this last one too, less so than 2013 though. And I think all three of these elections, I'm glad you raised this. I think they all build on each other and this is why I have optimism. I do read the comments under my pieces, you know, that I write for the paper and, that's a big mistake because people think I'm totally insane for
saying
this.
Never read the comments.
I don't know, man. I don't feed the trolls or
look
at them, but I do and I engage sometimes. It's a total catastrophe, but, yeah, man. You know, the first thing that comes to mind, and I've written about this too, the Rouhani campaign. I had the, thanks for a good friend, Jason Zayon, I got to go to Shahid Shirudi wrestling arena. Again, very close to the U.S. Embassy, across the street, in fact. There's a great swimming pool there. On this last trip, I'd go swimming there. It's a great sports facility, and it's close to my aunt's house. And Jason got us into this last rally, major rally that Rouhani had prior to the vote. And that place, man, I've never been in a sweatier, more youth-filled, packed place. Kind of like a punk show, I guess, in its own Iranian way. And then there's old me, like, hanging out. And the thing, you know, the audience, the call and response that was going on there, this is where your state and society are shaping each other, I think. And I was one of the questions I wanted to ask you is, you know, who's shaping whom, right? Who's actually reducing the gap? Because the crowd there, this is, again, 2013, in the summer of 2013, they're chanting, political prisoners must be released, political prisoners must be released. And what blew my mind was how young that crowd was. You know, these kids were 18 to 20, so they weren't of voting age in 2009. They'd seen family members beat up, thrown into prison, whatever. And yet they showed up, and they made sure that their voices were heard, at least at this particular rally, with a heavy state presence, by the way, security presence. You know, and then Rouhani comes out, and he does a speech, and he had his hokey, like his symbol that year, if you recall, was the key, right? So he had his... I think it's whatever. Get the key, like some papier-mâché key, like some high school kid had made for him. Like, you know, Rouhani is basically, his speech, his rhetoric that day was, I thought, reflective of what, you know, like J. Lo Rose says, give the people what they want, right?
Give the people what they want.
You can, like, cue that in right there in your podcast. Yeah, he was giving the people what they want. Why are our industries going to China, the carpet industry, right, the textile industry, you know, when we have people here at home who need jobs? Sound familiar, right?
Right.
Isn't this what a politician does? Why is our portfolio, yes, Iran has a right to nuclear energy, but why is our portfolio in such a position, this is obviously before that we now know that Khamenei had already started talks through Oman, right, before the election, but nonetheless, you know, why is Iran in such a bad spot internationally? We should be able to negotiate with, even with our enemies, etc. To me, yeah, this might be Rouhani's core beliefs or ideas, but I think that he was trying to hustle votes. This is what politicians do.
Yeah.
In Iran's crippled democracy, limited democracy, this part seems to be working. The people are very clearly, not just in Tehran, around the country, want certain things. They want normalcy. They don't want to be on the dark, you know, on the blacklist around the world.
Yeah.
Iranians are very proud of their society and culture. And they're very aware of, like, what people think of Iran and Iranians as, you know, quote-unquote terrorists or exporters of evil, all that sort of BS. And so they're very keen on having their state and their representatives, elected or not, sort of transform that image around the world by being good at what they do. Being, you know, Ahmadinejad was sort of seeing the antithesis of this desire. So Rouhani's responding, the call and response, he's responding to the crowd. And to me, that's a reduction of state and society. That gap is now not there, right? And again, you know, you made the point today on the FB, right? Like, Khomeini said one thing, and then he did another thing. All these documentation's come out. Like, and I love that you said, yeah, he's a politician. You know, this is like my first lecture in comparative politics. Like, yeah. Guess what? It's like Casablanca. I'm shocked. Yeah. The politician doesn't really believe what he's saying. Who cares? All that matters is, what does he do at the end of the day? I mean, I can't push that too hard, right? But I think the behavior of the policy outcomes is really what matters. And if, you know, a politician is calculating, as Hillary Clinton is often accused of being, so what? If she's calculating towards your way of, you know, your policy outcome, that's great. That means democracy is working here. So in any case, I think in Iran, you definitely see this process. People hustling for the vote. In 2009, definitely that was the case. 2013, you know, 2013 was also a year where there were city council elections.
Right.
And this is where the dope action really was happening. I mean, the presidential election is the sexy one, right?
Right.
But what blew my mind, Reza, I think there were like 30 spots, or I can't remember, like 20, let's say like no more than 36 spots for Tehran City Council. I should know this stuff. but anyways, the point here is 1,000 people ran for that thing, man.
Right.
I can't remember. It was a lot. And the city was festooned. Like, why are you running for Tehran City Council? And how are you presenting yourself in your advertising materials, right? These are people who probably made it past the Guardian Council. I don't know how stringent they are allowing people to run for that position. And a lot of the adverts were all about, this is what I can give you, this is what I can provide, you know, whether it's populist or whether it's my technical ability. People standing for office are presenting themselves in a way that says, it's not, I hate the U.S. or I stand for the revolution. That's a given, right? In many ways, that bar is already cleared just by virtue of you being in the political arena. Now they get to focus on providing some sort of a democratic outcome or output, which is basically, you know, again, giving the people what they want.
Yeah.
Whether they follow through on that, whether they have any power to actually do that. Now, that's a whole other question. That's an empirical question, I think. But I think the signs are clear from 2009 to 2013 to 2016. There's a sort of iterative process, a process of a democratic learning, citizenship learning that's going on. And frankly, on the part of the system or the state, which I hate to use that phrase because it obviously simplifies a very complicated, multifaceted thing, but, you know, from 2009 to 2013, Khamenei or the state could have doubled down on what happened in 2009 and 2013, and they didn't,
yep.
Right? They let this thing play out. Rouhani goes from like 3 or 6% polling to, you know, he wins easily in the first round. My understanding is he actually could have won by much larger margins, but they tamped down the results. So there's a, you know, a bit of conspiracy theory on that end of things. But yeah, you know, to its credit, the system realized that we can't have a repeat of 2009. We need to have the sort of reconciliation, reduction between of the gap. I'll just extend that notion that you raised earlier. And 2013 was the opportunity to do that. And to the credit of society, to these 18-year-olds, they showed up and voted.
Yeah.
Right? They didn't go out and beat up supporters of Ghalibaf or conservatives. And I'm referencing, of course, Bernie/Hillary supporters perhaps beating up Trump supporters yesterday or the day before in San Jose.
Oh, I didn't hear that.
You know what I'm saying? Okay. Yeah. They didn't go out and, as the Iranians had the first year that Ahmadinejad came up in 2005 and boycott the elections.
Yeah.
And this is part of the learning process, too, and everybody's written on this. That's not an original thought that I have. You know, like, we can't do this again. We have to show up. Huzur, right? Presence is very important.
Yeah.
So people rolled up and they voted. Even though they hate the system, they say. Even though they don't believe in the system, they say, right? They showed up at rates that would embarrass the Americans, 70, 80%. It was 85% in 2009, 4 years after a quote-unquote stolen revolution election. You know, it was like over 70% showed up and voted. Obama didn't even pull 60% nationally, right? I mean, in terms of total output in 2008 when he won the first time. So, you know, there's something to be said for a system that recognizes it needs to amend its ways, and something to be said for a society that's willing to keep pushing. Right, pushing that rock up the hill. And I think this is, and the last three elections have been very much, certainly 2013 was the culmination of 2009 in a lot of ways, right? I mean, the chants in the streets, and Jad Khali, your place was empty, Reza, you know, the streets of Tehran, Kayvon Harris, our friend, was out there with us. Mousavi, we got your votes back. Karoubi, we got your votes back. I mean, the kids were saying this in 2013. They remember what happened in 2009. And I think this parliamentary election that just went down, the Assembly of Experts as well, like, yeah, we're going to build on this. We're going to solidify the gains that we've made and get people into power who can incrementally move this thing forward, this rock up the hill forward. So if you asked me when I was 18 or 20 whether this is great, this is awesome, I said, hell no. Set this thing on fire, right? Like, we need revolution. You know, I teach a class called Revolutions for this reason. I was very fascinated, like, theoretically, intellectually, what is the point? What is the benefit of revolution? I've actually, maybe it's middle age, but I'm like, I've become more and more an incrementalist in the Iranian case specifically. I think, again, back to something I said maybe now 10 hours ago, the logic of the system allows for this sort of incremental progress. The sort of philosophy or the sort of reason for this revolution perversely allows for a sort of democratic breakthrough eventually. Whereas in a system like Gaddafi's or Saddam's Iraq, who cares, right? It's just naked power at that point, or the Tikriti clan, you know, being in power. But I don't think that's necessarily the case in Iran.
Yeah.
I might be wrong, but it seems to be, I mean, certainly this is not what the people want in terms of a violent overthrow.
Yeah.
I mean, screw that, right?
That's the most compelling thing is, you know.
Who cares what I think? It's what the people want.
Shouldn't that be the priority?
Well,
I mean,
You're in D.C., so.
well, that's the thing. Like, you know, 2009 election happens.
People speak on behalf of the Iranian people here all the damn time, right?
They take liberties with that. There's no doubt about it.
Let's get the MEK in there.
And I think there is a degree of savviness. There is an inconvenient truth where, you know, Iranians demonstrate that, you know, they prefer change without bloodshed.
Yeah.
They understand better than anyone the inherent limitations, frustrations, complications, and, you know, mismanagement, nepotism, corruption. You name all the negative adjectives that could apply to Iranian government performance. Iranians inside of Iran understand that better than anyone.
Yeah.
And yet, despite all of that, there is a level of sophistication where they say, we believe if we move in a certain direction, then enough of the political elite will see us moving in that direction, and they don't want that gap between state and society to grow so big.
Yeah.
So then enough of the elite move in the same direction that the people just moved in. And then my view is that Mr. Khamenei sees all of this, and he's like, well, I don't want to be on an island by myself.
Sure.
And then that is where the compromise within the system takes place, and that's the compromise between state and society,
even if
it's imperfect.
Is it a trap, though? So this is the thing that always trips me out, you know. So I teach Vaclav Havel, Power of the Powerless, and his whole thing is like, you know, this system, he's talking about Czechoslovakia, but basically the communist system in Eastern Europe or anywhere, is irredeemable. You either live the lie, he calls it the neo-totalitarian system, or post-totalitarian system, I should say, or you live in the truth. The lie is the system, right? And he has this famous parable of the green grocer who puts up the sign. You know it, right?
Right.
You know, workers of the world unite. Why does he put that sign up? Everybody knows BS, right? Why do you put up a picture of the supreme leader, et cetera? And, you know, this is part of keeping the lie. The emperor has no clothes kind of scenario going on. And I often wonder, and this is certainly the rhetoric I grew up with, you know, in the 80s with Reagan and all this sort of stuff about the Soviet Union, the Reagan himself proved to be pretty amenable with working with Gorbachev, at least. You know, is it a mistake? Is it a trap to get Khamenei on board, to get him off that island? Maybe we need to have him live in the lie, and we as Iranians, right, and supporters or, you know, participants in whatever, however we can from the diaspora, the Iranian population, we need to participate in the living in the truth, which means do not participate in the system, which means do not vote, which means all sorts of acts of subversion that are nonviolent, perhaps, but ultimately, I mean, frankly, I don't believe in that in the case of Iran specifically.
Me neither.
It might have been necessary for Czechoslovakia in the 60s and 70s and 80s, right?
Right.
I don't think it worked, given the historical context of Iran, is the reason why I feel this, and of course, how the people respond to it. But yeah, I often trip on this, like, maybe it's a mistake for me to write these pieces or to report back that things seem to be hunky-dory or moving in a positive direction, because the regime does still do, the system still does do horrible things, right? And we know this. And I know you guys are very good about calling them out on this. So how do I balance that? How do we balance that as analysts or part, you know, I wouldn't say participants in this movement forward, but at least enablers or, you know, supporters of what's happening in Iran? I don't know. Like, I mean, heightening the contradictions has never proven to work, I don't think.
So
I'm not interested in that. But
there's the difference.
I won't be complicit in something bad either. You know?
Something very valuable that I learned during my time in government was the difference between the theory and practice of international relations.
Yeah.
So we can sit here and talk about Havel and talk about maybe it's best to just let the Islamic Republic collapse under the weight of its own contradictions.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know what I would say in response to that? I would say what my bosses told me when I was at the State Department almost every day. When I would recommend things that were like pro-diplomacy and things, they'd be like, this is really good. Now let's inject some political realism into this. Which means, okay, here's how here's the world as we want it.
Yeah.
And here's the world as it exists, right? So what is the range of options that Iranians inside of Iran have at their disposal to make their lives better and to be able to provide for their families, both in the short, medium, and long run? And then all the way over here across the pond in Washington, D.C., what are the range of options that American officials have to promote the kind of changes that we seek, be it in Iran or any other country in the Middle East? And then also, why do we do certain things in some countries but not others? Here's what I say to you, my friend, and here's what I say to all their listeners, all the listeners that we have here, is America has interests and America has values.
Right.
And if we can promote our interests and achieve our values simultaneously, great.
Yeah.
Who would want to have their cake and eat it too?
Right.
That's a beautiful thing. But in the real world, you're oftentimes forced to choose.
Yeah.
Right? And 9-10 out of 10 times, America will seek to achieve its interests at the expense of promoting our values if that's the choice that we're facing.
Yeah.
So what do we do when it comes to Iran? We don't get along with the Iranian government, so we highlight all of the reprehensible things that the Iranian government does.
Right.
Fair enough.
Yeah, yeah.
But it cheapens the concept and it weakens the cause. If we do it in one country, say Iran, and we don't
Saudi
do it
Arabia,
in another country, like Saudi Arabia, which is just as bad, if not worse, on all of the
but
categories.
But they got Uber now, so that's cool.
Yeah, so now
so
women
now
will never drive.
That's right.
You know, there's a reason why Saudi pumped $3.5 billion into
that's right.
So, but this is the paradox that we constantly grapple with, is what is the best way to bring peaceful indigenous change to people that have long deserved it?
Yeah.
And I understand the argument that people make when they're like, you know, this government does terrible things. That's not the argument.
Right.
The argument is, what should we do about it?
That's a duh thing, anyways, right? We all know that. I mean, it's so stupid. Like, if I talk about how the state is providing, so the discussion should not be, you're highlighting how the state has provision of higher education for its population, blah, blah, blah. Why don't you talk about how women are being denied engineering degrees or women are being tortured and raped? You know, I can hold these two thoughts in my heads. These happen to occur simultaneously in Iran. The question for me is then, is our best hope here sort of the unintended or unexpected outcome? We do this, we stick with our values, do the best we can, given the constraints, as you're describing, in the hopes that we put the thought in abeyance, right, in the back of our head that, okay, this thing might lead somewhere. This is the limit of what's possible. But the concern, again, is, as I said, with schooling, you know, when you have every kid going to school, now they're committed to the system being reproduced.
Yeah.
Because that system is providing them with a bachelor's degree in mechanical engineering and maybe a pathway to going to Stanford, you know, for a PhD, or staying at home in Iran, having the indigenous education, right? And maybe that is perpetuating a system that in the long term is not beneficial to anybody in Iran or the world. That's the concern. I agree with you, actually. I think that it's not probably that. It's probably a scenario where by keeping the system going, then you allow the possibility of that different kind of incremental change from occurring in much better, much more likelihood, greater likelihood than if somehow we were trying to like stop going to university, let's say, stop participating in the educational system. Well, what is that going to lead to?
Yeah.
It's going to lead to a bunch of people ill-educated without work, right, and not married. So,
yeah,
I don't know.
It's a challenge across the board, both in theory and in practice. But I always look at the practical application of it. And whenever within the context of American politics, since I've become politically aware, like during Bill Clinton's first term onward, and then what I've studied from Ronald Reagan prior, because I didn't really live Reagan prior, I've only studied it. What I've seen...
It was a great time.
Oh, I can only imagine, especially if you're a minority.
Dude, bring that dude back.
Yeah.
I mean, better him against Clinton than this Clinton.
Well, you understand.
Than what we have now.
I mean, not to get sidetracked, but Make America Great Again, that was Ronald Reagan.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Donald Trump hijacked
that
from Ronald Reagan.
That's right. I always remind my students, too, where did Reagan kick off his campaign? Little town called Philadelphia. Oh, not Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, where I live.
Yeah.
Right? Philadelphia, Mississippi, where the movie Mississippi Burning was. So, like, I say that about Reagan, but of course, they're, you know. Some common threads here between the anyways. I'm letting my partisan stripe show.
No, it's perfectly okay.
Whatever.
That's what the podcast is for. So to bring it full circle.
Yeah.
Here we have a situation where every time the people who constantly and correctly, frankly, harp on human rights abuses and mismanagement, nepotism, and corruption, and pointing out all the things that the Iranian government doesn't do well, and pulling out all the things that are particularly reprehensible, and we're like, great, we are in agreement. And then the difference of opinion comes in what to do about it.
Yeah.
And when these people have held the power, what have they done about it? Death, destruction, bombs, bullets. It's not trying to save people's lives at the end of the day. We have to look at the practical application of it. If you try to promote democracy, human rights, and civil society through the barrel of a gun, I mean, in Iraq right now, over 90% of people under the age of 40 regret the American invasion and have a negative view of America. Over 90%. That, I mean, I can't curse. That's effing crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
Because the people that were the ideological architects and implementers of this policy during the Bush administration.
Right. Flowers.
Flowers, candy, unicorns, rainbows.
That's right.
All that stuff. And it didn't happen. And it's caused infinitely more problems for American power and America's reputation, not only in the Middle East and the broader Muslim world, but around the world.
So is your sense, I mean, my question for you, and I'm very curious about this because you were in the guts of the machine, the Daskar, right, as Iranians would say. You know, how do you know what the boundary between practical and value-laden, right, like the theoretical is? Or is it the case that, you know, it seems to be the case with the Obama administration. Certainly, I admire Obama's approach in this regard, like a type of political learning that's, you know, I think he made a mistake of labeling the Afghani war as the good war, right? And I think he's regretted that, perhaps.
Yeah, it's an oxymoron, if I've ever heard.
Yeah,
of,
I mean,
it's
turned
war.
Out to be, certainly the longest war at this point. But, how do you know when to, like, pull back, allow the sort of indigenous solution to occur, the practical... Because, you know, there's a strand of thought in IR, this is what you've studied, right? Like, as I understand, constructivism, right?
Right.
Like, you determine what's practical. I mean, there's no real practical or, like, realist model out there in the world. It's just whatever you determine. That's how, I mean, maybe I'm misdescribing this, but...
No, I don't think I'm misdescribing it. I just think that that's not how the application in U.S. foreign policy actually works. I think whether you're talking about constructivism or realism or any other ism that falls into the broader study of IR... It constantly gets trumped by more practical, political, and geopolitical interests.
But how do you know that? That's what I'm saying. Like, how do they know what constitutes the practical or geopolitical interest?
I will tell you.
Is that
it's one? It's crystal clear. It's crystal clear. America has set up a framework or an architecture for security in the Middle East, meaning we've set up rules of the game. After the British withdrew post-World War II, and there was for a short amount of time a power vacuum, we filled it. And we set up rules of the game. And then we went around from country to country and said, are you willing to play by our rules of the game?
What does that mean, the rules?
If you were willing to play by our rules of the game, if you were willing to allow American hegemony in the Middle East to help promote the stable and secure access to energy resources, not just for the United States, but for the rest of the world. We did everything in our power to help you stay in power at the expense of democracy, civil society, human rights, and all of these things that we describe as our values. If you did not play by the rules of the game that we set up, if you were the Islamic Republic of Iran, if you were Gaddafi's Libya, if you were Saddam Hussein's Iraq, if you were Assad's Syria, fact, we have done everything in our power to weaken, destabilize, or overthrow. And we do it under the argument of democracy, human rights, civil society. And it's true that all of those governments...
No.
Because,
I mean, you have Carter, you have the Carterite breeze, you have the Kennedy. I mean, you have different administrations. There's variation in this sort of rules of the game, right? Like, they're whether it's, and I already made my comment about sincerity or lack of sincerity, but it's certainly the case. I think the Kennedy administration, the Carter administration, specifically the Carter administration, did make a big deal about human rights. And if we put that in the forefront, do you think this was
but
all
not
just sort of bogus?
No, it's not bogus, but it was not at the expense of more practical geopolitical interests.
We didn't
meaning
stable supply of energy.
Carter and Kennedy
didn't
do what Bush 1 did to the Israelis, saying we're pulling the money.
Right.
If you don't fall in line.
Yeah.
Then that would have been putting interests ahead or putting values ahead of interests.
Yeah. So why did Bush 1 do it? Why did he violate
because
the
interests
of the
and values aligned. Interests and values aligned. It was determined in the post-Cold War world that it was in the interest of the United States to resolve this conflict, to help set up a new framework in the post-Cold War world in the Middle East.
Yeah.
And then Clinton comes into office and the Israelis and their ideological kindred spirits in the United States said, no, we have a better idea. We're not going to solve the conflict.
Yeah.
You know, we're going to work together to create these, you know, dual containment
where
you, America, are going to unilaterally contain Iran and Iraq. And if that sounds stupid, that's because it is. Because why should the United States expend blood, sweat, tears, and treasure and allow our allies to free ride?
So now we're talking, let's go back to state and society. Sorry, I'm playing professor role here.
No, we're just talking.
This is a conversational podcast. No, but that's your state and society gap at this point, right? Like, I think the American public clearly is not interested in that game anymore. They're not interested in, like, being the cop in the region, right? They're done with that.
Well, this is one of the reasons why Donald
Trump
is popular. Donald Trump is running as an anti-war, anti-trade deal candidate that is extreme right-wing on everything else, and that's a huge untapped voter demographic.
Yeah. I mean, so that it's funny. So you have this sort of elite game, this D.C. game, right? And I think too much can be made of that. Obviously, it's not a coherent or consistent.
Obama called it the bubble.
The bubble, right? Yeah. But, I mean, it's hard to break down. I think you're suggesting, and I think the evidence demonstrated, like, it's hard to break that structural, the rules of the game, whatever, that might have made sense in 46, 47, 48.
Yeah.
But here we are in 2016, we're still, like, trapped in this, like, BS, right? This morass here in the Middle East. I like how BS has become my euphemism for the sort of words I want to say. Like,
absolutely. Well, you know, because we have to keep it PG for the children. It would be much more adult language if Trita would allow me, but I have to.
Trita's like a sailor when I see him.
In an effort to keep this podcast going, I have to respect the boss man's wishes.
What if I use Farsi cuss words in that?
Oh, that's even worse.
I mean, we can do a little tangent here. I grew up with a lot of. I was raised well, but of course you hear certain Farsi cuss words, and then you don't know they're really cuss words until, or the origins of these words,
which are
actually pretty nice, like a puppy dog, like that word, or like a male donkey, like, I don't know, I don't want to translate these into Farsi, but in English they're meaningless, but in Farsi they, like, have a lot of meaning.
They do, and the best part was, you would, at least me growing up, you tell me if it was different for you, I would hear them. And then I would say them.
Oh, yeah.
And then
At parties and whatever.
Yeah. And then for a while, adults would laugh because they thought it was cute. But then I reached a certain age that was like the cutoff point.
Yeah.
If I said it would be like Zach Hamar, and I'd get smacked on the back of the neck.
Yeah. With Zach Hamar, which literally means the poison of a snake, right?
But they were saying that at me.
That's
right. That was always directed towards me.
Well, my favorite is Café Chaud.
Yes.
Choke.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very powerful way to tell someone to shut up.
Yeah.
Absolutely. But,
anyways,
you know, we brought it full circle.
Yeah,
we talked about a little bit of everything. I mean, so in the process of wrapping it up, I always like to ask people, do you have anything that you want to mention? Do you have anything you want to plug? Do you have anything?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I will plug. Oh, this is great. My new movie's coming out. No, I'm joking. So Fahy Defahy and Dan Brumberg being my advisor, both of them were my advisors, in fact. We have a new book out. What's the title of this book? I forgot the title. It's so bad.
So are they they're like the two lead editors, so their names will be on the, but it's about Iran specifically.
Yeah, no, it's basically, we started this, it's a USIP project. We had the Iran action group or something crazy like that. It took us many years to get this book out, but it turned out the timing was perfect because it was sort of a response to this idea that Iran's become a security state, or it's moved away from even the you know, pre-Islamic or pre-revolutionary history of a sort of monarchical rule or authoritarian rule. It was heading down this new military or sort of a security state path, more akin to maybe a South American state or some other countries in the region. And in fact, I think the evidence is showing that there's a much more contentious relationship between state and society. And I think every chapter in that book reflects that. My little humble brag is that the cover of the book is a picture I took during the 2009 Green Movement. So I'm really psyched that, you know, at least
I can contribute
to that. Yeah. So, of course, I have a chapter in that, too. But there's just, like, superstars in that book. I mean, I'm, like, probably the weakest chapter. So
very humble man.
That's my taught off there.
Exactly. You've been taught well.
Sorry. It doesn't count, though, if I admit it, though, right? Like, so that, yeah, I'm very proud of that book, actually. And I think, you know, we're all in this, Reza, as you know, to bridge, right, between the two places, Iran and the U.S. And I think this sort of book is in service of that, not withholding any punches where necessary in terms of criticism or, you know, cold analysis of quote-unquote bad things or illiberal things happening, but certainly looking at it in a much more sophisticated and ultimately, you know, humanistic way in terms of what the Iranians are capable of and interested in, both at the elite and ordinary level. And I think this particular edited volume has gotten a great response from really smart people. You know, I'm hoping that this sort of thing breaks out of the sort of academic circles ultimately. But I think also in the Monkey Cage, you know, Mark Litch has got a great thing going on there. I've been very fortunate, blessed to be able to participate in that forum, but a lot of people are participating in that, and it gets around, like, people are reading that stuff. It's still not breaking the conventional wisdom sort of narrative that's out there about Iran. Strangely enough, I think it takes things like the 2009 Green Movement to demonstrate to the rest of the world, you know, when Bon Jovi is singing, or I should say U2, I think Bon Jovi did something with Andy
he
too.
Did.
Yeah, that's right. I almost started weeping.
Wyclef Jean did something too, which was the most comical
that's
one.
Crazy.
I don't know if people remember this.
Yeah, there you go. You know, that sort of stuff. The Iranians themselves will carry the day, I think, at the end of the day. But a lot of us who are, you know, it's a very unique country in the region in terms of the dual nationality working on it, right? I mean,
right.
Mark Lynch works on Egypt, but he's obviously not Egyptian, or I don't think he is, but, you know, I'm Iranian American. I was born in Iran, raised in the States. Don't let my accent fool you. I was raised here in the States. No, yeah, I think a lot of this work is really part of that greater endeavor, right? We love both countries. We don't have dual loyalties in that sort of pernicious sense. We don't see it as a choice here. I think that's, at the end of the day, I think most of us consider ourselves Americans, right? But the avoidance of war, the participation in a project to avoid war between either country, and that's sadly, unfortunately, really the standard here for a lot of us, I think. I think you've probably agreed with that. Yeah, man. That's the sort of thing, it's a broad shout out to a lot of the scholarship that's going on around Iran. And hopefully we'll get people who are non-Iranian or, the ethnic background, whatever, participating too. There are issues of access, obviously, language barriers, I think. I can't think of anything much more than that. I like the last Linklater film about baseball. I had nothing to do with that.
I think it's
a Camus reference at the end, indirectly, so I'm down with the Camus.
This is all good. I mean, look, definitely go pick up the book, because in addition to Shervin being an awesome writer, Farid Afari is like the Michael Jordan of Iran analysts in the United States. And then also, Shervin mentioned Monkey Cage, which is a blog on the Washington Post, and he's been writing some great stuff. So go on the Googles, as my dad calls it, check him out. Read his stuff. It's always super thoughtful, and it's not the kind of stuff that you typically hear in Washington, D.C. particularly. And
here it is. I found the title. This
Power
is really...
and Change in Iran, Politics of Contention and Conciliation.
Yeah, it's all about the subtitle.
Ladies and gentlemen,
yeah.
There you have it. Go check out
on
the
Amazon.
Book. On Amazon. Available now?
Available. It's been available for close to a month, I think.
Available.
A little bit more, yeah.
Available
no,
right
since April, actually.
Hot
so.
Off the press.
Yeah.
Available now.
It was doing pretty well there on the Iran section. Iran history is a very small subgenre of Amazon books.
Still.
But, yeah.
Selling like hotcakes, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
Get yours while they last.
Yeah.
And thank you for coming
in
and doing
this.
Man. I appreciate it.
Thank you. This is a great honor. It's
absolutely.
Like, yeah. I mean, it's a real blessing. I mentioned this the other day. Reza was kind enough to come down to Swarthmore. And I think about what is the origins of this friendship. And it really is like time immemorial. Like, I'm not sure exactly.
Yeah.
Which makes it even cooler to me. Like,
I can't really remember either.
The origin
That's
point.
A good question. I mean, surely we must have met through a mutual friend.
It had to be FB.
Was it Kayvon? Was it Jason? Was it
Archita, maybe?
Was it Jadon? I don't remember.
Yeah, so anyways.
But good times have been had since.
Yeah.
And I appreciate it, man. Thank you,
brother.
Thank
you, sir. Appreciate it. Thank
Word.
You. Cool.